Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, going to be having a chat about Juan Pujol Garcia. This bloke was a double agent and a spy against Nazi Germany during the Second World War. And his story is absolutely amazing. So listen to this. All by himself, without the support of another nation, right, he fed the Nazis false and misleading information and invented a completely made-up spy network that the Nazis then helped to fund. Check that out. Initially, as I said, did this all by himself. He set this up by himself, this completely fictitious, this completely made-up ring of spies, right? All by himself. He was turned down by the UK initially when he came and offered to, you know, act as a spy on behalf of them. So he just did it by himself. You know, despite how effective his work was, the other nations didn't want to work with him until eventually, the British wisened up, realized how good he was at his job and brought him on board as well. Now, his work was instrumental in the success of the D-Day landings in 1944. You definitely heard of them. And quite aside from that, he tied up all sorts of Nazi resources as well, time, effort, and money, etc., that sort of stuff. Tied them up in wild goose chases all over the place. This bloke was absolutely incredible. And he did all of this, all the stuff that he did. He did, well, in his own words, he did it for the good of humanity. Not bad for a fella who started out in life as a chicken farmer. So I'm pretty sure, before we start, I'm pretty sure that this topic was sent in by a listener, but I can't find the email. I'm very, very sorry to whichever alert listener sent it in. I can't find the email. If it was you, let me know, and I'll do whatever I can to properly credit you for putting me onto this bloke, because, geez, what a story it is. And anyway, let's get to it. Let's have a chat about this bloke, Juan Pujol Garcia. I'm very sorry to all my Spanish listeners about how I'm pronouncing the name. Doing my best. In any case, yes, terrific story, utterly ridiculous moment. So here we go, let's get to it. We're going all the way back to 1912 here. On the 14th of February, young Juan is born in Motril, which is just south of Granada in Spain. Now, he's one of four kids. He's the third of four kids to reasonably well-off parents. His dad owned a factory or something like that. He was a reasonably wealthy bloke. But his parents, they sent him off to boarding school near Barcelona at the age of seven. And he then moved to another school in Barcelona itself when he was about 13. But look, to be honest, he wasn't super into school. After a couple of years there, he gave it the arse and got a job at a hardware store at the age of 16. And from then, he went from job to job, never really sticking at anything. He worked here and there. He was working as a manager of a cinema at one point, and he actually ended up going back to school to a university at level. I don't know if it was a university or what it was. It was. I mean, I'll just tell you its name. It was the Royal Poultry School. Which is a pretty interesting thing to have a royal prefix. I mean, you understand when it's the Royal Stables or the Royal Armory, but the Royal Chook College is a little odd. Anyway, he did animal husbandry there, so he's getting involved in chooks and learning about how chickens work, which end to put the feed in and which end their eggs come out of, that sort of stuff. So he's learning all that very technical stuff, very complicated stuff there, and on top of that, again, doing a bit of this, bit of that, none of it's hugely important until 1931, when he's called up for compulsory military service. Compulsory national service was a thing back then in Spain, and he's called up to join the military in 31, as I say. Now, you know how when your mum used to ask you to do something, like wash the dishes or vacuum the house or do whatever you do, and you do a bad job deliberately so she wouldn't ask again? That seems to have been the case here with old mate Pujol here, because he didn't seemed to have a very great time. He didn't really enjoy the soldiering life, his time in the military there, and as a result, he seemed to want to get out of it as soon as possible, and so he did as bad a job as he could. The soldiering life was not for him, which is unfortunate, actually, because after he's finished with his national service, he's actually not finished with the military and with soldiering quite yet. But after he's done with his national service, after he gets this taste of what it's like to be in the military and realise he doesn't like it, he does manage to go back to his chook farming, back to his beloved chooks, which he does until 1936. Now, as you might be aware, in 1936, the Spanish Civil War broke out. Now, He's conscripted for service once again, this time by the Republican forces there. Now, Pujol isn't a fan of the Republican side because they had arrested and imprisoned his mum and his sister. And apparently, you know, they'd been mistreated. They managed to escape later on, but apparently the Republicans hadn't been treating very well. So he doesn't want to fight for them, as you might expect. And rather than get drafted, he tries to dodge the draft and goes into hiding at his girlfriend's house to avoid being called up there. But doesn't work. The police, they raid her house and they find him, and he ends up imprisoned as well by the Republicans there, but not for long. Some resistance fighters, they bust him out. They make him some fake identity papers that put his birth date at a point where he'd be too old to be conscripted. So that's got, you know, sort of a little a free pass, get out of jail free pass. Well, it was not only a get out of jail free card that because they got him out of jail, also get out of conscription free card, which, you know, is in the advanced version of Monopoly. We don't often see that one. Anyway, he manages to go back to his original passion once again, chook farming. He's pulling, you know, those bum nuts right out of the chooks, having a great time doing all that sort of stuff. But again, wasn't a fan of the Republicans and their communist influenced politics. He's working at a poultry farm that had been more or less seized by the Republican faction there, and it wasn't particularly well run. It wasn't particularly economically viable because of the communism and or the communist influenced politics of the Republicans there, and so. Generally not being a fan of the Republicans in a general sense, he made a plan to escape their influence, their sphere of influence there, and defect to the other side by doing in what has to be a 400 IQ move. He joined back up with the Republican army. Now, that on the face of it might seem like a very bad, oh, I need to escape the clutches of this government. I know, I'll join their military. That's how I'll solve this problem. But it actually was a rock solid plan, because what he did after joining the army, he volunteered to get put on the front lines, right? He volunteered to be put out right on the front where they were fighting the nationalists there. And it worked like a charm. He's out there on the front lines. He was working on telegraph cables or something like that out there, right in the front lines. And then he defected. He deserted. As soon as he could, as soon as there was the first chance he got, he was running away over on the other side to join the Nationalists. This happened in 1938 during the Battle of the Ebro, right? Now, you'd think, fantastic, he's got what he wanted. He's over on the other side with the Nationalists. But nope, it was not. Well, things didn't go too well for him there either. He actually ended up being mistreated. And in what seems to be a recurring sort of theme in this bloke's life so far, being imprisoned. After disagreements with senior officers and a bunch of other stuff that happened to him that wasn't particularly pleasant, he ended up being locked up for a while and then, of course, forced to, you know, continue to serve in the military for the Nationalists here. Now, you know, it's not particularly surprising he had a bad time. I mean, a lot of people had a bad time with the Nationalists. The Nationalists were actual, factual, real-life, literal fascists, so, you know, probably isn't going to be much of a surprise that there are a bunch of nasty pasties there. But it leaves a very strong impression on young Juan here, because at the end of the day, once the Spanish Civil War has ended and he's discharged and he's about, you know, can go back to civilian life, he's had a bloody gutful of both. He's had a terrible time with both the communists and the fascists, and he bloody hates both of them. He hates totalitarianism in all its forms, and sort of by extension, you know, as well as the communists and the fascists that he's met so far, he also has a deep and abiding hatred for both the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, who supported the respective sides during the Spanish Civil War. He is quite proud, however, of one little fact that sort of came out of this whole thing with he's involved fighting for both sides. He's quite proud that despite having served for both the Republicans and the Nationalists, he didn't fire a single shot. He didn't shoot a single bullet throughout his time as a soldier, not even once for either side. So nice one there, old mate Juan. Done a pretty good job sticking to your guns. Well, not sticking to your guns, actually. Yeah, you stuck a long way away from your guns, as it was. Anyway, Pujol's experience as a soldier, it left him feeling the need to do something. Again, in his words, he wanted to do something for the good of humanity. And so he decides, as you do, to start working as a spy. I mean, not necessarily the career path that we all take, but in this bloke's case, it definitely worked out pretty well for him, as you'll discover. Because by this stage, it's 1939. The Second World War is underway, and Pujol he's determined to do something to oppose the Nazis and, by extension, the Franco government that the Nazis supported. So, you know, he's looking to sort of offer a little bit of resistance to the fascists that are both at home in Spain and abroad, over, you know, in Germany, whatever else. Paul, he approaches the British. These are obviously the principal adversaries of the Nazis. Things aren't going too well on the continent. So, you know, the United Kingdom is more or less leading the charge against the Nazis at this stage. And he goes to them no fewer than three times, offering to be a spy for them. But each time he was turned away. Now, that's, you know, kind of defensible, reasonable enough, you know, without the necessary vetting and background checks and whatever else like that. You know, you're not just going to take any Joe Blow off the street and have him become a spy for you. So that's fair enough. But as you'll discover, bit of an error for the British, because this bloke, I tell you what, he knew what he was doing. Because after he was knocked back, he goes, no worries, I'm just going to get to work on my own, no dramas, I'm going to set myself up with the Nazis as a spy, and then I'll come back to the British later once I've got the Nazis fooled. And quite incredibly, well, this is exactly what he does. Puhol, he pulls together this fake identity, right, that he used to trick the Nazis. He portrayed himself as a government worker who was, very sympathetic, just bloody loved the Nazis, someone who was able to make business trips to Britain as part of his job. So obviously someone who would have been, if this were true, would have been pretty valuable for the Nazis. Obviously someone who could access London and the rest of the United Kingdom, whatever else, without raising suspicion. He also tricked a printer somehow, no idea how he did this, but he tricked a printer into making him a diplomatic passport. And with this and his cover story, he then approached a Nazi spy master who was based in Madrid and offered to work for him. Now, this absolute turkey, he fell for Puhol's story, hook, line, and sinker, and gave him his orders. He thinks this is brilliant. Got this Spanish bloke here who's he's all about what we're doing back at home, and we're going to send him into Britain as a spy. We'll get him to pull together a spy ring and feed information back to the Nazis back home. They're like that. So this spy master, he trains Puhol in basic spycraft, gives him £600 and a slap on the ass, and off Puhol goes to Lisbon, not London. So despite having been ordered to go to London to set up a spy ring there, to find contacts and see if there's any information that he can send back to his Nazi contacts there like that, he doesn't go to London, he goes to Lisbon. And here comes one of the most amazing parts of Puhol's story. Strap yourselves in for this one, because I'll tell you what he did once he was in Lisbon. He had to make his Nazi handlers believe that he was in London, right? Going about recruiting all these British spies. Do you know how he did this? This is how he convinced his Nazi contacts that he was in London and not in Lisbon. He went down to the local library and picked up all of the British travel guides, books, and magazines, as well as anything else that he could find that gave him information about the UK. He watched newsreels, he researched British current affairs, he read through train timetables, anything that could help him pretend to be in Britain for his reports. And once he'd done his research, he started sending false reports to the Nazis using all the little details that he'd picked up in travel brochures, in order to trick them into thinking that he was in Britain. How incredible is that? You know, he's sending them a report saying, oh, you know, I've been here, it costs this much to get the train, I've recruited this bloke, or been there, uncovered this bit of information, whatever else like that. He wove such a complicated and intricate web of lies. And the Nazis, they loved it. They were completely taken in by it. So much so that they chucked more and more cash at him to support this supposed spy ring that he was in the process of setting up. These reports, as I say, they were written to make it seem like he was in the UK sending out information or whatever from London. But everything was just all, he just pulled it straight out of his ass. He's just making it all up on the go. The whole time, he's cutting about in Lisbon, having a lend to the Nazis, and they are falling over themselves to take on all this information that he's given. It's unbelievable. It just worked. It was incredible. And the best part about all the information that he was sending, and look, this isn't a knock on old Puhol, who is doing an incredible job, doing terrific work here, right? It's not a knock on him. But his reports were full of mistakes, full of stuff, full of all these little things that just a cursory bit of research would have proven that he couldn't have been in Britain. I'll give you a couple of examples here. He didn't understand British currency. The British system of currency back then, it was 12 pence to a shilling and 20 shillings in a pound. And so he stuffed up a bunch of expense reports that he'd sent back to them because he didn't know how to add them up properly. He didn't know what all the numbers and that sort of stuff, you know, he wasn't familiar with it. But the Nazis didn't notice, and they paid him all the money that he asked for, you know, after having sent these expense reports. Unbelievable. Can you believe this, right? Full credit to him. He's sending in intelligence reports seemingly from London without even being in the UK. But as I say, absolute howlers in what he was writing. For example, here's one that I find pretty, you know, I live in Glasgow, so I can speak a little bit of personal experience on my part with this next claim he said. He said, he claimed that he had a spy in Glasgow who would do anything for a litre of wine. Now, never mind that Glaswegians would never, ever, ever drink wine that isn't, you know, a bottle of Buckfast, a wee bottle of Wreck the Hoos juice, as I understand it's called, a little splash of the commotion lotion. On top of that, right, the UK didn't even use the metric system back then. So they wouldn't have known a litre from a decagram at this stage in their history. So he's, you know, not necessarily huge plot holes in everything that he's sending back, but definitely enough that anyone who, you know, was even a little bit familiar with how things should have looked in these reports, it should have been raising some red flags, but it didn't, you know, despite the fact that just a little bit of research would have discredited everything that Pulhall was reporting to them. The Nazis, they gobbled it up. They gobbled these reports up like absolute turkeys. They couldn't get enough of him. In fact, the Nazis took his report so seriously that British MI5 counterintelligence efforts actually discovered some of Pulhall's reports being circulated at a high level. Right? And they couldn't figure out what was going on. They're going, who is sending, you know, these are long comprehensive reports that have been written out that make no sense, but we've got some, you know, they seem real enough. We're going to have to worry about this here. They kicked off a great big spy hunt to try to find who was sending off these reports that seemed to be coming from within the UK. That, I mean, you know, forget even having the Nazis fooled. He also, to a point, had the British fooled because they're worried about having a spy somewhere sending off all these reports, despite the fact they don't seem to really make any sense to them. Anyway, this continued until 1942, if you'll believe it. He's doing this for years and years and years, by which time Pulhall, he has wasted so much Nazi time and money with his rubbish that the British, they couldn't ignore him anymore. Obviously, they couldn't find this spy. There was no spy for them to find. But their research had shown that someone was unloading these absolute whoppers onto the Nazis who seemed to be falling for it. And so they, at the end of the day, they go, look, we just want this bloke on our side. We just want him. We just want to get in on the action here because this bloke's an absolute pro. We know what's going on here. The final thing came when Pulhall, he tricked the Nazis into sending a detachment of their navy to hunt down a completely fictional British convoy. They're sailing about trying to find this convoy that he's just completely made up. And after this, you know, after the British realize how effective this bloke is, they go, right, we've got to bring him in. We've got to learn from this master here. And so he's finally recruited by MI5. He makes contact with them through some Americans that he knew, and he manages to actually finally get recruited by MI5. He was moved to London after years of pretending to live there. He actually finally moved, and now actually does. He moved there in 1942, and he was paired with an MI5 handler, a bloke named Thomas Harris. Now, this bloke also spoke Spanish, and these two worked very, very closely together over the coming years, and they did some of the most incredible things you're ever going to hear. So he was given the code name Garbo. This was his spy code name. And this was because, I quite like this, this was because, according to MI5, he was the best actor in the world, and so he was named after Greta Garbo. This was after they had discovered this massive fake spy ring. His spy ring had up to 27 different identities, all of them fake, all of them with thorough backstories, different motivations, all this. He's basically running a 27-person D&D campaign to try to trick the Nazis, and they've absolutely fallen for it, as I say, and so the British are more than happy to bring him on board, and they give him this this nickname Garbo because of how good of an actor he is. So Pulhall brings Harris in on this entirely made-up network of spies, and now the two of them, they go to town on the Nazis. They continue to send in more and more false reports, but the thing is, now he's on side with the British. They can actually start to sort of pepper it with enough truths and enough sort of irrelevant details that are actually, you know, demonstrably accurate, that the Nazis are starting to get even more impressed by the quality of information that they're receiving. So this is a very, very good thing here for Pulhall's career as a spy. And he and Harris, they absolutely overload the Nazis with reports full of misleading or, you know, just untrue information. Again, peppered in with enough believability, enough stuff that's going to protect his credibility there like this. And again, the Nazis never suspected a thing. In fact, Pulhall and Harris, they sent through so much information, such an enormous volume of information that seemed to be, you know, so exhaustive and comprehensive to the Nazis, that the Nazis never made any further attempts to infiltrate Britain with spies. They thought they had it covered with their bloke Puhol there, so they didn't even bother sending in any more. We've got everything. We've got all the angles covered. There's 27 spies hanging out in the UK, all headed up by this bloke. We don't need any more on there. Imagine this. This bloke's nonsense was so convincing, it was so effective, that the Nazis believed that they didn't need to bother to make more of an effort to spy from within the United Kingdom. Incredible. Anyway, Paul and Harris, they are sending the Nazis all sorts of stuff. As I say, a lot of it was total rubbish designed that was to waste time and resources, but it was paired with other stuff to make sure Puhol's worth as a supposed spy remained intact. They would send through real, actual military information that was of very little real worth, right? So stuff that was either irrelevant or, you know, sort of didn't matter too much, or, which is this is the other thing they did, which is very, very clever, they would send through very important, highly sensitive information just a little too late for it to be of any use. I'll give you an example of what they did. One time, just after the Allies landed in North Africa as part of Operation Torch, this was in late 1942 here, Puhol's made-up wine-drinking Glaswegian sent in a report that a stack of ships that were all in Mediterranean camouflage had just left the River Clyde. Now, obviously, this would have been very important. It would have allowed the Nazis to figure out what was going on, where these ships were going, what maybe their next move was going to be. And this is why. This was the genius move here, right? Puhol sent in that information, this critical military information, but he sent it in after the invasion took place, but postmarked it before it took place. So it just seemed like the letter had been delayed in the post. They get it, the Nazis get it, they go, oh, gee, just too late. Oh, mate, if we just received this a day or two earlier, you can see he sent it on time. Oh, unbelievable. How's this for bad luck? Even though this information was completely useless for the Nazis, as obviously it was received too late and the invasion already happened, they were thrilled that he had managed to gain such sensitive information, and they thanked him for his magnificent work. So he's kicking goals with both feet, as our mate Puhol here. He's doing a great job. But he did have to cover his ass, however, because there were some sensitive and important bits of information that he couldn't send through that would have actually, you know, been of a great detriment to the British there. But it was information that his spies definitely should have known. So he and Harris had to come up with cover stories as to why he hadn't sent through stuff that, you know, if he were a real Nazi spy, he would have. So, for example, I'll give you an example here. When a naval convoy left Liverpool one time, the British didn't want the Nazis knowing about it, but for him not to report it obviously would have raised suspicion when they eventually found out that this naval convoy was on the move. So Puhol, he covered by saying that his spy in Liverpool had fallen ill and wasn't able to report the convoy. He'd missed it. But this is, this is the equivalent of turning up to school and being like, oh no, I was sick. Well, did you bring a note from your mum? Nah, I was just sick. He found the note from his mum. Do you know what he did? A couple of weeks later, a Liverpool newspaper published an obituary for this totally made-up spy. This bloke who didn't exist, a Liverpool newspaper published an obituary for him, so the Nazis would then see that and be like, oh, that makes sense. He was sick. He missed that, the boat's leaving there like that, the ship's leaving, and then he died a couple of weeks later. He was obviously very unwell. How smart is that? Incredible. So this is the sort of stuff that these two are doing, Puhol and Harris, working together and pulling the wool over the Nazis' eyes. In 1943, however, things change a little bit because Puhol and Harris, they start sending in their reports to the Nazis via radio. They invent a new spy who conveniently just happened to be a radio operator. How very lucky indeed. And the reason they did this, or one of the happy consequences of this at least, was that now, because they're communicating via radio, Puhol needs all of the Nazi encryption codes and whatever else that they use to send radio transmissions. And the Nazis give it to him. They furnish him with all the radio codes, which he, of course, then passes on to the British, including the famous code breakers at Bletchley Park. You may have heard of them. And even better than that, right, because Puhol's messages, he would encrypt them, send them to Madrid. And in Madrid, the Nazis would then encrypt them using the Enigma machine, another thing you've probably heard of there, this code machine that the British were working so hard to try to crack. And the Enigma encoded messages would then be sent to Berlin. Now, importantly, This meant that the people in Bletchley Park who were trying to crack this Enigma code, they now had the plain text versions of the messages that they were intercepting in Enigma code and trying to crack. So I don't know if this is a little difficult to follow, but what would happen basically is Puhol would give Bletchley Park the plain text message that he would then send to Madrid. Madrid would then encode it and send it to Berlin. Bletchley Park would intercept it, and then they would have next to them the plain text and the encoded messages next to each other. So, you know, this is kind of like a, you know, answers in the back of the maths book situation here, where they didn't have to work from scratch. They had both the plain text and the encoded version together to work through. So obviously a massive help in trying to decode, you know, the Enigma machine. And part of the reason that British code-breaking, British intelligence was so successful during the Second World War. And again, thanks to this bloke Puhol here. So safe to say that Puhol was very meaningfully influencing the shape of the war, but this was just the start of it. You may have heard of the Enigma machine, you may have heard of Bletchley Park and the codebreakers there, but you have definitely heard of the famous D-Day invasion, codenamed Operation Overlord, when Allied forces landed on the beaches of Normandy in northern France on the 6th of June 1944. It was one of the most decisive events of the Second World War, and as you can imagine, it was very carefully planned down to the nth degree. Now, part of that planning and part of the reason that D-Day was so successful for the Allies was all of the secrecy and the bluffs and the double bluffs and the smoke screens and everything else that hid the real plan from the Nazis. All of this deception that was used to, you know, cover exactly what was going on with Operation Overlord, that was codenamed Operation Bodyguard, and it itself consisted of several other operations that were all aimed to confuse the Nazis in different ways as to what was really going on. Now, obviously, the Nazis had caught wind of Allied invasion plans. You can't keep a plan that big that, you know, you can't hope to keep it secret. So this meant that it was critical that the Allies kept the Nazis guessing as to what was actually going to take place. They didn't want them making proper, real preparations in you know, that were going to be able to counter the plans that the Allies were putting out. Now, you may have heard of the lengths that the Allies went to. They made, you know, dummy ships and planes, and they rolled out inflatable tanks. They drew up fake battle plans that involved different invasion locations. They deliberately leaked information here and withheld information there. The whole thing was just, you know, a big smokescreen to try to, you know, bamboozle and trick the Nazis into basically, you know, confusing me to not knowing what was going on there. But one thing that definitely helped the British in doing this was having a highly trusted and highly valued double agent on their side. It meant that the British were able to feed just the right amount of misinformation over to the Nazis in the lead up to D-Day. As I say, the Nazis knew that the Allies were cooking something up, and so they got in touch with Puhol in January 1944, and they asked him to find out exactly what was going on. They wanted to know what these invasion plans were, and they tasked Puhol with getting as much information as they could and sending through as many reports as he could about the Allied plans here. And so, as a result of this, Puhol was a critical component of Operation Fortitude, one of the sub-operations of Operation Bodyguard, which was designed to convince the Nazis that the actual landing site for the invasion would be Calais. Now, obviously, we know it wasn't Calais, it was in Normandy, but everything that Puhol did, all these little snippets of information, everything that he did was designed to slowly and but surely manipulate and trick the Nazis into thinking that the invasion was going to be in Calais. Between the January and the actual invasion, which obviously took place in June, for 6 months, Puhol and Harris are sending report after report after report, all aimed slowly driving them towards this conclusion here. They sent over 500 reports to the Nazis via radio. That's average. That's about an average of 4 a day, all with these little tiny bits of information, little crumbs of information that were designed to trick the Nazis into thinking the landing would be in Calais and not in Normandy. And this was critical. The reason for this: the Nazi defences along the French coast were spread very thin indeed. And so if they ended up concentrating their defences in one area, obviously that would then leave the other areas much more vulnerable. Now, on top of this, on top of trying to trick the Nazis into thinking the Allies were going to land in Calais, there was another element to what Puhol and Harris were trying to achieve with Operation Fortitude, one that was much, much more ambitious than that, right? Not only were they instructed to trick the Nazis into thinking the invasion would be in Calais, right? They were also instructed to keep the Nazis believing that the invasion was still coming in Calais even after the Normandy invasion had taken place. I mean, that sounds ludicrous. It sounds impossible. How could you convince the Nazis that they weren't being invaded in Normandy while they were being invaded in Normandy? Pujol and Harris were tasked to execute an absolutely masterful plan. What they were going to do, right? What they were going to tell the Nazis that the invasion in Normandy was just a diversion. It was a ruse that was designed to draw the Nazi troops away from Calais before the real invasion took place there. This was the strategy that was designed to keep the Nazis tied up at Calais, expecting an attack there for as long as possible. Now, this plan that Pujol and Harris had never panned out. They actually never managed to give this information in the way that they planned to. This is, check out what happened, right? Pujol had arranged for his Nazi contact to be ready at 3 o'clock in the morning on the 6th of June, the day of the landing, and he told them that one of his agents was arriving with critical information overnight, and they needed to be there ready at 3 o'clock to receive this critical information that was going to, obviously be of utmost importance here. Now, this critical information was about the Normandy landings, and it was going to be delivered too late for the Nazis to actually do anything about it, but, of course, it was going to bolster his credibility as a spy because it was still coming in advance. It was still something that, he couldn't know unless he was a spy or, as it happened, a double agent. And to capitalize on the credibility that he would earn from, giving them this information, or even though it's too late, right, he would then go on to tell them that Normandy was just a ruse, it was just diverting their attention away from Calais, and that the real attack was coming to Calais shortly, so that's where they needed to focus their attention. But get this. Despite this critically important appointment that Pujol had made at 3 o'clock in the morning, the Nazi contact never showed up to receive the transmission, and Pujol wasn't able to execute this plan as it had been, as it had been set out here. So initially, this seems like terrible news for Pujol, who, the whole idea was that he needed to convince the Nazis to bolster Calais and stay away from Normandy. But now he can't do it. He can't do it because this bloke hasn't showed up for the meeting. And all of a sudden, this whole plan in order to, try to convince the Nazis that the Normandy attack's happening no matter what, and he needs to feed this information through to make sure they only think it's a diversion. Otherwise, they're going to run guns blazing from Calais down to Normandy to try to defend their turf over there. So he's in a bit of a trouble here, is Pujol, because this whole plan is not quite hinging on what he has to say, but it's very important that he keeps the Nazis tied up at Calais. But he doesn't give up. He realizes, he's in a bit of a pickle here, but he realizes that he is going to be able to turn it around. And so our boy, he doubles down and he goes after them even harder. When his Nazi contact finally shows up sometime after 8 o'clock in the morning, Pujol went mental at him. He tell him he was disgusted. He had this critical information, he had this critical message to send through, and it had been missed. And then, right, with the authority of the British government, he gave them all this other technical information about Normandy to add to the information that he was supposed to deliver to make it even more convincing, even look even more like even more of a coup, even more of this amazing scoop, this information that he'd found there, made it seem even more valuable. And this, again, shored up his credibility as a reliable and valued source with the Nazis, and it was important in the lead-up to what was probably the most important report that Pujol ever sent. After this whole thing, after this missed call, it actually set the stage for a transmission that Pujol made that, in a very real sense, had a supremely strong influence on the outcome of the Second World War. And I'll tell you what happened here, because on the 9th of June, 3 days after the Normandy landings had begun here, Pujol sent through an extremely long and exhaustive report about this supposed invasion of Calais. He and his other colleagues there, they'd taken the time to write up this massive fictional report about how this whole invasion of Calais was going to take place. He talked about the hundreds of thousands of troops in southeast England. He talked, about how they were ready to be deployed to France. He talked about the vehicles and the hardware that was all ready to go. And he reinforced the idea that Normandy had just been a diversion and this massive invasion force was getting ready in the southeast of England, ready to jump over the channel there and in towards Calais. Now, Pujol's reports were also supported by other Nazi recon reports. Had been, you know, scouts had been scooting about in the air and having a look from a long way away as to what was going on down there in southeast England. And sure enough, they were seeing all of these ships, all of these planes, all of these tanks, all this stuff that seemed to be ready to go there like that. Of course, all of which was completely fake. These tanks and planes and ships were made out of balsa wood or just completely inflatable, right? They were just a complete fabrication there. And the consequence of this is that the Nazis are completely taken in. On the one hand, they've got all of this, you know, recon information about the huge amounts of troops and hardware and whatever else that's mustering in the southeast of England. And on the other hand, they've got this highly reliable, highly valued source coming from, you know, the beating heart of their espionage efforts in the United Kingdom that all points towards Calais being where the Allies are going to land. This information went up all the way up the Nazi chain of command until it was in the hands of Hitler himself. And I am pleased to say that even he was absolutely and totally bamboozled by our good mate Puhol. And as a result, he ordered the full reinforcement of Calais. And this marked the complete and total success of Operation Fortitude and was one of the key reasons that the D-Day landings were so successful. The Nazis kept the bulk of their defensive forces in Calais rather than move them to Normandy to reinforce their troops there. This meant that the Allies were able to establish and entrench themselves in Normandy successfully. Due to the lack of reinforcements and the extra time that had been bought by Operation Fortitude, the troops that landed there on the beaches in the north of France were able to stay there, dig in, and fight a fight against the Nazis, and as we all know, as history tells us, slowly but surely beat them back towards the east. The Nazi troops didn't move from Calais for months. They were still there in August, still anticipating this huge attack that they'd been falsely put onto by Puhol and the rest of them there like that. In fact, the Nazis were so convinced that an attack was coming for Calais that even in August, there were still more troops in Calais than there had ever been in Normandy, even during the D-Day attack itself. So, obviously, look, there was so much that had to go right for the D-Day landings to be the success that they were, but Puhol's work as part of Operation Fortitude meant that the Allied push into occupied Europe started about as well as it possibly could have. The Nazis wasted their time and their resources defending the beaches in Calais from, let's not forget what they were defending them from, inflatable tanks, mate. Inflatable tanks kept the Nazis at bay, all because Puhol had put the spook into them, put the scare into them, and they were fearing this attack coming towards Calais. On top of this, what makes this even sweeter here? The Nazis never realized they'd been tricked. They never realized that Puhol had pulled a fast one on them. From go to woe, they believed that he was the real McCoy. And as a result, and this really is absolutely brilliant, Puhol's contribution to the Nazi war effort was deemed so important by the Nazi high command that he was awarded with the Iron Cross Second Class. And, you know, you might stop and think, whoa, why is that brilliant? It is brilliant because he was also awarded an MBE from King George VI of Britain, meaning that he is one of the only, if not the only person, to receive a medal from both belligerent parties during the Second World War. Puhol knew, however, that his good luck wasn't going to last forever, and MI5 agreed with his assessment that he might be in a little bit of danger as the war wound down. There are a couple of scares about him being revealed as a double agent. None of them actually ever, you know, came to any fruition, but he was, you know, there was a lot of risk associated with the work that he did, obviously, and even after the war ended, there was, you know, if he was discovered as to have been a double agent, there might have been repercussions from Nazi sympathizers who had, you know, survived or had, you know, escaped retribution or whatever else like that once the war had finished. So as a result, when the war was well and truly over, MI5 actually helped Puhol disappear so as to avoid any reprisals from Nazis or Nazi sympathizers, so, you know, who found out who he was and what he'd done. So in 1949, with the assistance of MI5, Puhol moved to Angola and died of malaria. No, of course that's not what happened. Well, that's what's happened. That's what happened officially, at least. That's what, you know, obviously, you know, no repercussions if you're dead, right? So MI5 helped to fake his death there in Angola. And, you know, this story that they'd cooked up was designed to prevent any further interest in Pujol. But in truth, Pujol moved to Venezuela, where he lived out much of the rest of his life as just a regular bloke. He managed a book and a gift shop in Lagunillas until the 80s, actually, when he moved to Caracas instead there. So at this point in his life, he's more or less still completely unknown to history. And this was the case until the mid-80s, until 1984. And in 1984, between the end of the Second World War, when he'd been doing all this incredibly important work that had changed the course of world history, all the way through to 1984, he lived in just relative obscurity. I mean, you know, almost total anonymity, basically, on the other side of the world there, like that, the other side of the Atlantic. Until 1984, as I say, when a bloke whose name was Rupert Allison, he became very interested in the story of this double agent, who was known, you know, in MI5 circles as Garbo. He became very interested in what this bloke had done and who he was and all that sort of stuff, and did a bit of investigation, a bit of digging to find out what this bloke's story was. He did everything that he could to hunt him down, to find out his story and you know, have a chat with the bloke. And it took him over a decade. He started looking for him in 1971, but it was finally in 1984, after having discovered Pujol's name and after having, I mean, you got to love the detective work, he called every single person who shared Pujol's name in the Barcelona phone book. Allison finally got in touch with a nephew of Pujol who gave him information as to where to find him, all that sort of stuff, and that led Allison to meet Pujol in New Orleans in May 1984. Now, Allison persuaded Pujol to visit the United Kingdom, and he did so that same year and met Prince Philip, as well as a bunch of his old colleagues from MI5, and it was at this point that his story became much more broadly known, as he shared it with the rest of the world, and a lot of, you know, the previously sensitive details and information about his former life as a spy now emerged for us all to enjoy, as we're doing exactly now. As part of this visit in Europe, he also went to Normandy on the 40th anniversary of the landings there. He was there on the 6th of June in 1984. And again, let's not forget these landings, you know, the anniversary of the landings that were being celebrated there. These landings owed much of their success to him. Their long-term success was guaranteed by Operation Fortitude in no small part thanks to the work that Pujol did. And, you know, his story emerging and becoming known to history in this way after he you know, sort of came out, not from hiding, but came out from his seclusion on the other side of the Atlantic, I'm just so glad it did. I'm so glad that we all got to share and celebrate and enjoy this story, because I tell you what, it's an absolute belter. I'm sure you'll agree. I mean, what a story. What a life this bloke had. But of course, like every other story, it does have to have an end. And Juan Pujol Garcia, his story ends on the 10th of October in 1988 in Caracas, when he died at the age of 76. And I tell you what, what an incredible story he had. What an amazing life he led. From a humble chicken farmer to a disillusioned soldier to a self-made spy, all the way up to influencing the course of world history. And all, once again, in his words, all for the good of humanity. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the story of Juan Pujol Garcia. And I tell you what, I'm so glad to have been able to share that. I'm so glad to discover it myself. What a story it is, and what a bloke this fella was. I mean, quite an astonishing tale. So I do hope you've enjoyed it just as much as I did telling it to you. Anyway, that's that for another week. Usual boring housekeeping stuff here. Halfasthistory.net is your place for all things to do with the podcast. You can find old episodes there, links to not only ways to subscribe to the show on iTunes and Android and Spotify there, but also, of course, to the Patreon. And I'm very pleased to again remind you that merch is on the way. At the moment, I've got t-shirts planned, tote bags, if that's something that I've had a couple of people indicate interest in that. So if you're interested in them, I might make them. If you've got any other suggestions, I'm kind of moving away from stuff like mugs and things like that, because they're a bit heavier and I don't want to have to sort of blast people for shipping across the world for them like that. So anything that might be light, portable, easy to send around, maybe bookmarks or something nerdy like that. I don't know. If you've got ideas, please let me know. The best way to do that, of course, is at halfasthistory.net. There's a contact form there. And I do have people sending in topics every single week. I've got a list as long as my arm. I do get through them all. I've at the moment, I've responded to nearly every single email that people have sent in. If I haven't responded to you, just email me again and I'll try to get back to you. But thanks so much. Thanks so much for being part of the Half Arse History family and listening every week. Or if you're new to the show, welcome. Welcome, by all means, welcome. Hope you'll stick around for a couple more episodes. But it's always great to hear from people, so please do get in touch if you've got thoughts to share. Anyway, that's enough of that nonsense for this week. We are going to close out the show as usual with a question posed on Reddit here. Reddit historian Doug, that's a prime piece of Reddit real estate there. Doug wants to know, obviously been talking about the invasion of Normandy a little bit, so Doug's got a question to do with that. If the invasion of Normandy was so successful, why did it only get a D minus?